This week, we're thinking as a community about community. Monday, we explored the perspectives of personalism and communitarianism. The day before yesterday, we looked at the ways we might work for communities at work. Today, I'd like to suggest that we think about nature and community and nature as community. Usually, when you use the term community, we mean convocations of human beings. But increasingly, Americans are coming to think of community in more extensive terms. That rethinking of community came in part from the 60s, especially that part of the spirit of the 60s that spilled over chronologically into the 70s. Today, I'd like to tell the story of environmentalism and what one author calls the backyard revolutions that came from the political personalism of the 60s. Near the end, I'd like to think a little bit about what personalist environmentalism might mean for us now. The backyard revolution of the 70s, which was evident really more in the 70s than in the 60s, drew on the localist and communitarian emphases of 60s political personalism. The national liberation movement, predicted by Marxist and Maoist revolutionaries of the late 60s, failed to materialize. But local liberation movements flourished in what Harry Boyd called the backyard revolution of the 70s. And this has been one of the most interesting things to me in this research. When I started doing this, I thought, well, the 60s sort of end in 1970 or 1972, or maybe with the end of the Vietnam War in 1974 or something like that. But when I got looking at it, I couldn't find a place where they really end. The kinds of ideas that were really central to the 60s continue all through the 1970s and into the 1980s, and even right now. Holden Village is an example of a community founded in the 60s based on what I would call 60s personalist principles that seems to be flourishing just fine. The Para College at St. Olaf, where I teach, is an alternative experimental college that was established in 1969, and it's also doing just fine. So they're all around, mostly at the local level. You will see the 1960s if you're looking closely. The backyard revolution was a subset of what the 60s called the here and now revolution. It was an attempt to live the revolution where you were rather than waiting for something to happen in Washington. More than 20 million people took part in the neighborhood groups created by the New Citizen Movement of the 1970s. More than 500,000 mutual aid groups came into existence with membership of more than 15 million. Cooperatives added more than 1 million members a year during the 70s. These backyard revolutionaries organized to prevent highways or urban development from ruining their neighborhoods, to lobby for occupational health and workplace reforms, to create cooperative institutions, to agitate for tenants' rights, to protest utility and rates and property taxes, to combat bank redlining and capital flight. The backyard revolution, said Boyd, had roots in the 60s protests against institutionalized discrimination, massive bureaucracies, and technocratic values. Like civil rights, its fundamental theme is the rights of citizenship, the demand that democracy be made real in America. The 70s citizen revolt drew on local communities, churches, and traditions, just as 60s personalists had drawn on religious and small r Republican precedents. It also learned from the women's liberation movement that personal issues often included a political dimension requiring cooperative action for change. Suspicious of big business and big government, both of which treated people as abstractions, the backyard revolutionaries institutionalized participatory democracy and personal politics close to home. Part of the backyard revolution was the organization of cooperatives. As the 60s slipped into the 70s, many activists began to live the revolution, not in the streets, but in the storefronts of America's neighborhoods. Because protest and resistance seemed ineffective against the entrenched institutions of American government, many activists turned their attention from Washington to their own localities. They formed food and housing co-ops, credit unions and insurance co-ops, health care and daycare co-ops, and community development corporations. Co-ops constituted an institutional infrastructure for people who had dropped out of American life and into another form of American life. They embodied participatory democracy, giving people an actual voice in the economic institutions of their neighborhoods. As examples of community economics, the co-ops provided goods and services outside the profit nexus and the institutions of competitive capitalism. They were what in the 60s people called parallel institutions. The co-op suggested that if the political was personal, then so was the economic. While communes tried to change the relationships of the household, cooperatives focused on the relationships of the market. And I'll talk a little bit about communes on Saturday. The foundation of the movement, said Craig Cox, was an almost religious belief in the value of community and personal empowerment. The co-ops embodied the communitarian anarchist idea of mutual aid, and offered a nonviolent protest that seemed more productive than street confrontations. Cooperatives offered a model of social change more rooted than the riotous revolution of the streets. According to Cox, co-op leaders expected to change society individual by individual, neighborhood by neighborhood, through cooperative empowerment. It would be a revolution without guns, without dogma, a revolution that always valued the individual over political parties, people over profit, peace over provocation. In the terms that I've been using, it would be a personalist revolution. Food co-ops offered not just cooperative organization, but also an approach to a more nutritious diet. They carried whole grains, dried beans, organic produce, and unrefined sugars that were more natural than the plastic foods of the supermarket. Early food co-ops refused to carry junk foods and stocked cookbooks like Francis Moore LePay's Diet for a Small Planet that connected the dinner table to issues of agricultural production and distribution and ecological destruction. Like Holden Village, they connected the personal and the political to the palatable. There were lots of five bean soups that came out of the co-ops. Like many of the cooperatives, food co-ops encountered practical difficulties that prevented them from realizing all of their goals. In many cases, economics forced diversification to attract a wider clientele at a cost of the personal and participatory relationships that accompanied smaller enterprises. Because small co-ops couldn't compete with supermarkets on economies of scale, they often offered workers a negligible wage or some sort of payment in kind. Because they were countercultural, they had a hard time attracting people from the community they were supposed to serve. But co-ops, like other community organizations, offered a way to institutionalize the spirit of the 60s, even as they prefigured the more comprehensive revolution that never happened, or hasn't happened yet, let's say. Like the backyard revolution itself, food co-ops stayed mainly in the back pages of the newspapers. Although they challenged the system, they didn't overthrow it. Instead, in the face of the supermarket system, they provided good food and food for thought. I want to talk a little bit now about the environmental movement. And one of the really good histories of the environmental movement is entitled Beauty, Health, and Permanence. And that, I think, captures what the main thrusts of the environmental movement since the 1960s have been. Until the 1960s, beauty was probably more important than either health or permanence. But in the 1960s, people began to notice that the environment around us was killing us and was unhealthy for us. And so health became a central issue in the environmental movement of the 60s and 70s. And then permanence also became an issue. Can we sustain the practices that we have? And so beauty, health, and permanence are the main themes of the environmental movement. Like the backyard revolution, the environmental movement of the 1970s also depended on the idea that people should think globally and act locally. In fact, the NIMBY syndrome, N-I-M-B-Y, not in my backyard is what it stands for, of grassroots environmentalists coincided perfectly with the citizens' movement's emphasis on local action for state and national policy. And in a way, what it does is to say, if you don't want to dump in your backyard, why would you want it anywhere? Think about it. You know, try to think about how policy, big policy, might be connected to backyards everywhere. Although the mainstream of the environmental movement was more liberal than radical, there have been important personalist perspectives. Just as personalists rejected instrumental approaches to people, so many environmentalists resisted the instrumental use of nature and began to argue for nature's inherent value. Going back to Genesis, religious environmentalists noted that God created the earth and said that it was good, even before populating the garden with human beings. Instead of seeing people and nature, deep ecologists saw persons in nature. At the same time, contemporary environmentalists stressed themes of personal responsibility. Robert Holdsworth noted that environmentalism not only criticizes the ecological consequences of corporate capitalism and bureaucratic socialism, but explicitly endorses the personalist tenet that individuals have to assume responsibility for problems in the world. The personalist harmonies of private and public, religious and political, which we've talked about before, were increasingly extended to culture and nature with the hope that people would be able, both personally and politically, to embrace nature in a communitarian ethic of ecological harmony. The widely praised land ethic of Otto Leopold made this communitarian vision explicit. He said, "A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, beauty, and stability of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." Most variations of radical ecology also assumed the holism of creation. I'm going to talk just about a few of the variations of radical ecology in the 1970s and still now. Bioregionalist variations of radical environmentalism emphasize the decentralist and communitarian versions of personalism. Beginning with former digger Peter Berg and San Francisco's Planet Drum Foundation, bioregionalism came to public consciousness in the 1970s and 1980s, reacting against the scale of national and international markets and the fossil fuels required to supply them. Bioregionalists focused on life, human and non-human, within particular watersheds. They created questionnaires, like the one on one of your handouts there. There's a one-column thing called Where You At? That demonstrated the displacement of most people. What a handout like that suggests is that most of us haven't a clue where we live. I once heard somebody who's a bioregionalist ask a group of students to give instructions on how to get to their house without using any human artifacts. Could you do it? I mean, usually you just say, well, you go up to this street, you turn right, you go to the second stoplight, and you turn left, or something like that. Take out the human artifacts. Could you describe where you are? Probably not, for most of us. Bioregionalists emphasized life in place instead of the mobilities of American life. And like Catholic worker Peter Morin, they asked people to eat what they grew and grow what they ate. Politically, the bioregionalist vision tended toward a communitarian anarchism in which each individual would act as a public person. Like these other perspectives, deep ecology, which was another variation of radical ecology, gave Americans perspective by incongruity on the dominant modern worldview, as the rest of that particular handout suggests. It also offered an alternative that was personalist in many of its perspectives, again, as you can see in the contrast between the dominant and minority traditions on that handout. Ecofeminist perspectives added a gender dimension to varieties of environmentalism and emphasized the traditionally feminine virtues necessary for a sustainable society. Ecofeminist ethics challenged traditional ethics of rights, rules, and utility with ethics of care, love, and trust. An ecofeminist partnership ethic emphasized the partnership of humans with each other and with non-human nature. Constructing nature as a partner, says Carolyn Merchant, allows for the possibility of personal or intimate, but not necessarily spiritual, relationship with nature, and for feelings of compassion for non-humans as well as for people who are sexually, racially, or culturally different. Ecofeminist women have been particularly prominent in protests against nuclear power and the disposal of toxic wastes. Another person who has advanced a kind of personalist environmentalism is Wendell Berry, whose poem I read this morning at Matins, and it's on that handout the other handout that I gave you. Berry is a Kentucky farmer and writer who exemplifies many aspects of recent personalist environmentalism. Born in 1934, he was educated at the University of Kentucky and Stanford University and began teaching in 1959. In 1965, Berry moved to Lane's Landing Farm in Port Royal, Kentucky, where he has farmed ever since. Although he was no hippie, it would be really hard to think of Wendell Berry as a hippie, Berry's return to the land was countercultural. In The Unsettling of America, which is, I think, really his manifesto, published in 1976, but appropriately enough, the bicentennial year, Berry argued that the ecological crisis was a crisis of character, because people routinely made convenience of enterprises that they knew to be morally and even practically indefensible. The public environmental crises of the 70s, he said, were no more than the aggregate of private absurdities. Berry especially attacked the system of specialization that divided and diminished the traditional functions of character, workmanship, care, conscience, responsibility. Although he understood the importance of the competencies that specialization promoted, he decried the compartmentalization of responsibility. It's a phrase that I like a lot, the compartmentalization of responsibility that characterized the system. Trained to do one thing well, specialists often overlook connections to the wider world. That same system of specialization and remote control, which would be another way, if I'm actually, I did a piece as Dr. America about a remote control, thinking that remote control is what we use to operate our televisions. But in fact, it's a metaphor for all of American life. We remotely control the whole environment, and in many ways, the world, by the way that we live our lives. This system of specialization and remote control diminished people and distanced them from nature. We have given up the understanding, Berry thought, that we in our country create one another, depend on one another, are literally part of one another. Berry's solution was relatively simple, although immensely difficult. The only real, practical, hope-giving way to remedy the fragmentation that is the disease of the modern spirit is the small and humble way, he said, a way that a government or agency, organization or institution will never think of, although a person may think of it. One must begin in one's own life the private solutions that can only in turn become public solutions. Berry knew that environmental bureaucracies and organizations promoted, quote, wise use or responsible use of the land. But he insisted that the use of the world is finally a personal matter, and the world can be preserved in health only by the forbearance and care of a multitude of persons. And that term forbearance is really important. I was reading a description of ethics also this week, and it said basically that forbearance is the one thing that ethics asks us to do. I mean, and that's the essence of ethics, is to figure out what it is that you don't do to be in community, and what it is that you don't do to be in community with people, or what it is that you don't do to be in community with the earth. In a terrific essay called The Reactor in the Garden, which I recommend to all of you, it's in his book, The Gift of Good Land, Berry extended this analysis to anti-nuclear politics. Describing his participation in a protest against the Marble Hill nuclear plant about 20 miles from his farm, he recalled that, quote, as a father, as a neighbor, and as a citizen, I had begun to look upon the risk of going to jail as trivial in comparison to the risks of living so near a nuclear power plant. And what's really fascinating to me about that phrase is the way it begins, as a father, as a neighbor, and as a citizen. And what he's basically saying there, that is, as a father or a mother, as a parent, you have a responsibility for your children to do public things. In his case, he could not believe that as a father, he could be a good father unless he protested that nuclear power plant. And what is then to say is, as the personalists always did, is that what we think of as your private roles always have public implications to them. To be a good parent means to be a good citizen. So as a father, as a neighbor, as a citizen, he took part in a demonstration of nonviolent civil disobedience, trespassing on the property to publicize the trespasses of the company. Berry believed, though, that while such protests were necessary, they were not sufficient for solving the complex problems that they identified. Protests could raise consciousness, but they were what he called incomplete actions, because they could only raise consciousness to the level of protest. They could raise enough consciousness to get you to go to protest, but they didn't necessarily do anything else. They did not extricate people from complicity with the evils, like energy wastefulness, that they were protesting. Nearly all of us, Berry said, accusing himself too, are sponsoring or helping to cause the ills we would like to cure. The roots of the problem are private and personal, and the roots of the solution will be private or personal too. Berry advised people, therefore, to quit doing things that they knew to be destructive and to practice what he called a politics of complete action. For Berry, a complete action was one which one takes on one's own behalf, which is particular and complex, real, not symbolic, which one can both accomplish on one's own and take full responsibility for. A garden, he said, was an elegant example of a complete action, connecting people to nature, disconnecting them from some part of an industrial food system. A garden offered good work in the pursuit of health, and a particular place to deal with the most urgent question of our time: how much is enough? Unlike a nuclear plant, which solves one problem by creating others, a garden was a solution that leads to other solutions. It is a part of the limitless pattern of good sense and good health. And if you want to read more about the garden as a solution, or just thinking about gardening, a really great book on gardens is Michael Pollan's book called Second Nature, in which he really thinks through what he learns from gardening. While very few Americans were attracted to the disciplined personalism of a Wendell Berry, many were interested in less heroic measures. Books like Ecology at Home, published in 1971, and 99 Ways to a Simple Lifestyle, 1977, and Muddling Toward Frugality, 1978. I always like the ones with the muddling stuff in them, because that seems to me that's the way we're likely to go. And Taking Charge of Our Lives, Living Responsibly in the World, 1981. Voluntary Simplicity, also 1981. Home Ecology, 1990. And How to Make the World a Better Place, 1990. Have proliferated in the 30 years since the 60s. Spreading the message of personal responsibility and political involvement. And all of the 50 ways that you can X, I think, are examples of personalism. These are the spirit of the 60s and the 90s. This is what you can do. There was also a larger movement in the 70s of smallness called appropriate technology. During the 1970s, this movement for appropriate technology drew on personalist perspectives. The search for economics as if people mattered, which was the subtitle of E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful, and for technologies appropriate to the humanity of human beings were both a part of personalism's legacies. Appropriate technology focused on machines for particular purposes, but altogether they were machines for social transformation. E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, Economics as If People Mattered, which was published in 1973, was one of the most widely read books of social criticism in the 1970s. Schumacher, who had spent 20 years as the head of Britain's National Control Board, argued that modern technology and politics conspired in the dehumanization of society. If technology is felt to be becoming more and more inhuman, he wrote, we might do well to consider whether it is possible to have something better, technology with a human face. The human-scale decentralism of Schumacher's Smallness echoed Peter Morin's Green Revolution from the Catholic Worker Movement and the anarchism of 60s personalists like Paul Goodman. Schumacher's concept of Buddhist economics was remarkably similar to the personalist thinking of the Catholic Worker. Like them, he called for good work, for right livelihood, for voluntary simplicity and nonviolence. The Buddhist, Schumacher said, sees the essence of civilization not in the multiplication of wants, but in the purification of human character, primarily by a man's work. He decried the gigantic systems that degraded human beings, and he used the principle of subsidiarity from Catholic social thought to justify the decentralization that would maximize freedom and responsibility. The Whole Earth Catalog was a second scripture for the smallness movement. In explaining its purpose, author Stuart Brand contended that a realm of intimate, personal power is developing, power of the individual to conduct his own education, find his own inspiration, shape his own environment, and share his adventure with whoever is interested. The catalog advertised hundreds of tools for creating a new society in the shell of the old, from books of philosophy to how-to manuals, from windmills to solar collectors, from cookbooks to carpentry, from birthing to burial. The Whole Earth Catalog emphasized local self-reliance and the revival of lost low-technology skills. Launched in 1968, it grossed $500,000 in 1969, whereupon Brand promptly reduced the price by a dollar. Hundreds of groups, including the New Alchemy Institute, which I'll talk about a little bit later today, the Rocky Mountain Institute, the Intermediate Technology Development Group, and the Farallones Institute, also organized to protest the status quo by pretesting alternative technologies. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance, created in 1973 to put Paul Goodman's educational ideas into practice and still in business today, coordinated many of these projects. They experimented with solar and wind power, with transportation technologies, with heating and insulation efficiencies, with aquaculture and permaculture. With its small-scale machines, appropriate technology challenged the machines, both literal and metaphorical, of corporate capitalism, echoing the communitarian anarchism of many political personalists. In general, appropriate technologists practiced a politics of example, hoping that if they built a better mousetrap, the world would come trooping to the door. For the most part, like many political personalists, they opted for the here-and-now revolution of personal and social change on a human scale. Their major successes, however, were neither mechanical or social. Instead, they were intellectual. They challenged many of the main assumptions of the modern technological society. They made Americans think twice about the meaning of basic concepts like efficiency, rationality, productivity, cost, and benefit. And they added new measures of success, human scale, the interconnectedness of things, second law efficiencies, and sustainability. The concept really that refigures everything. The environmental movement and environmental consciousness constitute one of the most lasting legacies of the 60s. Increasingly, although we act otherwise, we think in frameworks that are ecologically literate and sensitive. We understand that human communities depend on natural communities or ecosystems that support them. We know with Wendell Berry that to think of one thing is not to think at all, which is one of my great, that first day of class, I always want to put that up on the board. To think of one thing is not to think at all. We know that the earth is interconnected and that our own actions create reactions all over the globe. We know that we are destroying the sustainability of the earth, but knowing is not enough. We need also to do some unknowing. We need to unlearn ideas and habits that have been formed in the last few hundred years of human existence. We need to unlearn, for example, the idea that nature is property. We abuse land because we see it as a commodity belonging to us, observed Otto Leopold 50 years ago. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. We need to unlearn the idea that nature is not us and that we are not nature. Usually when we speak of animals, we are speaking about other species. But our own species, Homo sapiens, is a species of animal in more ways than one, since interestingly enough, the Latin root of the word animal is anima, which means soul. We are, as Thoreau said, nature looking at nature. We are also, I think, nature thinking for nature. And we need to learn to think not just for human nature, but for all of nature, which enables the human kind of nature to survive and thrive on this planet. The idea of a biotic community, which was Aldo Leopold's idea, might prove helpful to us in this unthinking and rethinking. A biotic community is a group of plants and animals adapted to live together. They don't do all of the things that human communities do, but they do some things that we do and don't think about. They die and feed one another in what ecologists call nutrient cycles. We might begin to think of society as a nutrient cycle, providing not just the materials for physical growth, but for personal, social, and spiritual growth as well. We might ask ourselves at any time, what am I doing to nourish the processes that I value most? And I think about the ways in which we are nutrient cyclers in our work, in our families, and things like that. We also need what some writers call full-bodied understanding, the sort of experiential learning that was the common knowledge of agriculture. We need it especially as the number of farmers decreases. As Wendell Berry notes in his essay on conserving community in the book Rooted in the Land, the number of farmers is now so small that the Census Bureau will no longer count the number of Americans living on farms. At least as a special category, farmers do not count. But farmers embodied a way of knowing that we still need. As Scott Russell Sanders says in his book, Staying Put, what I mean is plain and simple. Body and land are one flesh. They are made of the same stuff. Their beauty is one beauty. Their wounds the same wounds. They call to us in the same perennial voices, crying, come see, come touch, come listen and smell, and oh, come taste. We explore them alike, honor or abuse them alike. The health or sickness of one is inseparable from that of the other. There is no division between where we live and what we are. And this is an idea that's also really eloquently stated in the chapter called The Body and the Earth in Berry's The Unsettling of America, which is one of the most beautiful essays that I've ever read. Given this identity of the body and the earth, we need to enhance our sensual experience of the nature that is us and the nature that is about us. Beyond an understanding of nature and of the nature of human nature, however, we need to think about what Edward O. Wilson calls biophilia, the innate affections that humans feel for connections with nature. David Orr calls it more simply love. He quotes Stephen Jay Gould, "We cannot win this battle to save species and environments without forging an emotional bond between ourselves and nature as well. For we will not fight to save what we do not love. And it's even harder to love what you don't know and you can't name." If you think about that, there's not a lot of nature that we can name, but it's very hard to say, be married to somebody and not know their name, or to have children and not name them. It's people that we can name who are most intimate to us. And so it's probably a good idea for us to begin to learn to name the things around. And I think we also need to be able to name things close to us and to love things close to us. I think many of us come to Holden Village because we love the mountains, but we may not love the lawns, for example, around us, or the sort of edge environments that are in our suburbs or around our homes. We also need to understand that to name those and to love those in some way. Scott Russell Sanders says that we need to learn to live with nature with generosity and restraint that characterize all good relationships. This generosity and restraint means basically living within the boundaries of what Wendell Berry calls the gift of good land and the gift of sunlight, which Michael Pollan discusses in his book, Second Nature. In the chapter on the harvest, he reminds us that the popular fear that we are using up the earth is in part misguided. We are using up finite quantities of fossil fuels and minerals. We are losing topsoil to erosion and salination. We are affecting the atmosphere adversely. But the planet, Pollan notes, is not a closed system. Plants grow not from the earth as we commonly think, but from the sun, which daily bombards the earth with new energy. There is a free launch, says Pollan, and its name is photosynthesis. In one of his essays, he talks about an experiment where they had a big pot with, they put exactly 200 pounds of soil in it, and then they planted some kind of seed in there, and they grew a plant that weighed about 400 pounds in it. And they took the plant out and they weighed the amount of soil that was there, and it was like 199 pounds and 98 one-hundredths of a pound. I mean, it doesn't take soil to do that. It's sun that does it. And so, in a way, what we need to do is to sort of figure out how to live as sun people. And I think I'm going slow today on some of this. I'm going to switch to that right now and talk about the work of the New Alchemy Institute, which is run by John Todd and Nancy Jack Todd. It's actually under a different name now. And they offer a way of thinking about how we might live within the Earth's means. In addition to asking us to be at home with nature in places like Holden, they are asking us to bring nature home with us. They began to experiment with what they call living machines. A living machine is a collection of plants and animals arranged to take maximum advantage of the work that nature does for free. Housed in what the Todds call bio-shelters, greenhouse-like structures that contain the living components of the machine, they can help us find a right relation with nature close to home. And I want to give you some examples of that. Here I'm working mainly from their book called From Eco-Cities to Living Machines, Principles of Ecological Design. And this phrase, ecological design, I hope will be one that you'll hear much, much more of in coming years, because there's some really interesting things going on. And their idea basically is that waste is just a misplaced resource, that if you think about things, you can figure out how to use them. And in a way that, you know, there's the old computer adage, garbage in, garbage out. Well, they want to say that that's not always true, that garbage in, sometimes really wonderful things out. And I'll provide a few examples of that. With their living machines, what they're trying to do is to imitate nature. And so they try to, in these living machines, which might be rooms as large as this or even larger, they're trying to put assortments of plants and animals and water, particularly. Usually their bioshelters are 70% water, since the Earth is 70% water. So there's a lot of aquaculture involved in what they're doing. But they're trying to imitate nature's processes. And basically what they're saying is that human beings now have enough information to begin to do that, to begin to use nature as nature to do the things that we want, and to get what another author that I'm going to talk about Saturday calls regenerative design, which is basically that for the last 200 years in a fossil fuel economy, we've been involved in degenerative design. The things that we've been doing have been really degenerative toward the planet. And now it's time that everything that you do replenishes itself. So going back to Genesis, you know, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. The replenish part is the part that Wendell Berry and these people are talking about. Can you do things so that you actually end up with more at the end than you started with? Most mechanical systems don't do that at all. And their idea is to try to do that. And often they do it by combining functions, which any natural system does automatically. They say living machines are fundamentally different from both conventional machines and standard biotechnologies, presuming a novel range of qualities which are summarized in Table 2. And you have another one of your handouts is from their book on living machines. What they represent in essence is the intelligence of a forest or a lake reapplied to human ends. And I'll give you a few examples here. They have constructed living machines that do water purification, and in some cases water purification for whole cities. And in some, they're working on a living machine now, I think in San Francisco, where they're going to do a whole city block. And what they bring in is wastewater or sewage or something like that, and they bring it in at the top of what is usually a sloped thing, and they start running it through tanks of water that are filled with different kinds of plants that take nutrients out of it. So they're growing plants, they have trees in there, they grow fruit in these bio-shelters. They have different species of fish which agitate the water in the ways that ocean currents do, so that they get the water to move up and down and the nutrients to move in the water and to feed the algae which are at the top of the water, which devour some of the toxics that are in there. They use water hyacinths, which are the best plant that they've found so far, for taking toxics out of water, and can get water to about 98-99% pure, which is better than a standard water treatment plant can do. And then at the end, and throughout all this, they design it so that people can walk in there. These are, it's like a sewage treatment plant that is like a park, so that people can be in there and be attentive to the processes of their lives. And part of what they're trying to do in this whole thing is they're trying to make all of the processes of the human ecosystem visible. So in water purification, they do that. They also have done some sewage purification. And since at 2 o'clock today, sewage is going to be on our mind, I thought I would talk about one of their plans. And that was for within a city. They've proposed, but not actually yet designed or made, what they call a solar sewage wall, which would be on a city street. Might have, say, buildings here, and a street here, and then the sidewalk would be the space here. Well, they would propose putting in a living machine here, where you might take all of the sewage out of all the buildings on this city block here and run it through this living machine. And this would be a wall about 6 or 8 feet high on the street side, and then it would be sloped down on the other side. And it's all made out of glass so that you can see all the plants that are in there. And the sewage just filters its way sort of back and forth through the thing, moving down in the way that water moves and being purified in the process. It provides a filter between the street and the sidewalk, cutting down on noise and car traffic noise and even some of the air pollution stuff that would go there. And it would be a way of making visible to us the things that Philip Slater says that Americans operate in general on the toilet principle of life, which is out of sight, out of mind. And this is a reversal of the toilet principle of life. Another thing that they've done is to try to combine agriculture, aquaculture, and architecture all together in these bioshelters. So they have created some bioshelters where they're trying to grow trying to grow fish for protein. And they particularly want that for third world countries where they've done some work, like in Costa Rica, because it's a cheap source of protein. But they're also trying to grow crops, and particularly permaculture crops like tree crops and nuts and things like that. And they're trying to combine that with architecture. And what they're trying to get is what they call integrated architecture that's integrated into the environment so that you can see the interactions of nature and culture. And they juxtapose this to what you might call unintegrated architecture or disintegrated architecture, like a skyscraper, which is just, it's all human form. And people may bring a few ornamental plants in there, but the plant, and actually those plants do something. They do purify the air to some extent. But the Todds are trying to think about ways of integrating the architecture so that the plants and animals are doing even more than that at the end. Another thing that they have proposed for urban living is that since urban people depend on farmers, and since farmers are eroding soil at a tremendous rate right now, they think that urban people ought to start manufacturing soil. And there's a picture in this book of an urban compost bin that would be on every city block. Everybody would compost, because composting is cheaper than any other form of garbage removal. And they have these great big steel barrels that are, the barrel sort of is like this all the way across a sidewalk or something like that. And then there are bicycles mounted on the side of it where the wheels rub up against the barrel, so that people on bicycles would be rotating the barrels the way that you do with compost to make it work more quickly, so that people would get their exercise at the same time that they were moving their compost around. And they did this when they first formed the New Alchemy Institute. They did it on Cape Cod, where the soil is really bad. And then the first year, they scavenged garbage dumps of the different cities around and asked the cities actually to deliver garbage to them. And they produced 10 tons of compost, 10 tons of soil in the first year. It's really remarkable. And again, this is stuff that, for the most part, is just wasted now. So composting in the city by city block.
You just have to ask them. Doesn't it smell pretty bad?
It does if there's not enough air in it. But if there's enough air in it, it apparently doesn't. Most of these things they say would be very pleasant to be in. In some of the things they're in enclosed clear plastic tanks. So even if there were a smell, you wouldn't smell it being in there. But it would be like being in a big aquarium or something like that. Another thing that they've proposed is what they call the Venice Project, which is to say, in a city that has a sort of a normal grid system and traffic along all kinds of streets, is simply to dig up one of the streets, and on every block, and actually to put a canal through on a city street, and to use the canal for water treatment and things like that, but to have it deep enough that kids could play in it in the summertime, and then to drain it down to about 2 to 4 inches in the wintertime so that you could have ice skating in local areas. Because again, what they have in mind is not just to be part of community with nature and to be doing things in a kind of a technical way, but to bring community together. So all of these things are designed to have people observing them and taking part in them in a participatory way, which we don't when we just flush or things like that. And one other thing that they have in here that I think is real interesting is what they call a warehouse farm, which is to take an old urban warehouse that's not used for anything anymore and to convert it to farming. And they have a proposal here for a farm that could work on 4 levels of a warehouse with like lettuces and tomatoes at the top and working down to chickens at the bottom. And all of this would be a kind of an integrated farm, recycling nutrients within the farm and producing stuff that could be sold on a local market. So again, the kind of decentralization and communitarianism of a lot of the stuff I've been talking about comes into play there. Well, let's conclude today by reading that poem that I read this morning, just because I love to read it, and now you have a copy of it.
So,
there are copies around somewhere, I think. Or did we run out of copies? I think we ran out of copies, so if you're with somebody that you can share with, please do and pass that around. The stuff on the other side of it, Landscape and Desire, I haven't mentioned yet. This is a questionnaire that Paul Grucco did for the Hungry Mind Review, and I think it's one of the most evocative questionnaires I've seen. Paul is a Northfield, Minnesota writer. One of his books is in the bookstore over here. That's his best book, I think, is called Grassroots. But he's also written Journal of a Prairie Year and The Necessity of Empty Places. He's one of the great nature writers in America right now. And his third question, for example, I think is just a delight. Why is gardening the most widely practiced hobby in the United States? When you can't resist planting a few peas in the backyard on the first warm day of spring, what is it that you crave? Peas? And his answer to that, of course, is no, it's not peace. It's something else. It's a relationship with nature that you're looking for and that you ought to redesign your life so that you have more of that relationship with nature. Okay, so Wendell Berry, Manifesto of the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die, and you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear out your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. Actually, it just occurred to me in looking at that practice resurrection, now that I've read it for maybe the 500th time in my life, that in terms of regenerative design is essentially practicing resurrection. That's what it is to try to resurrect out of the things that you've used something else, some other use, to keep it going, to keep life alive in the world. So do we have questions, comments?
What's your opinion on Biosphere 2? Was it they were trying to do too much?
Yeah, they were doing too much and
too complicated.
In a way, they set themselves a challenge that was not necessary. I mean, but there's no particular reason that humans need to be able to live in large spheres without other human inputs. What the Todds are doing is some version of really bioshelters like that. But they're always expecting that they'll be monitoring what's going on and be able to make inputs if they need to. And what the Biosphere tried to do was to say, we can do this whole thing and run it for 2 years without that. And very quickly they had to pump more oxygen in because they weren't getting enough.
Would you call that a partial victory or just focus a lot of people into ecology more? Would you call it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the idea that we need to think about how nature works and to try to mimic that in the way that we work with nature is real important. And there are lots of ways that more and more people are doing that now. For example, nature doesn't plant crops in straight rows that are 6 feet apart with lots of dirt in between that can blow away. It just doesn't do that. So at the Land Institute in Kansas, Wes Jackson and a whole team of biologists are trying to create what they call they're trying to essentially imitate a natural prairie and to breed grasses like corn that will grow year after year after year, and that will be not monoculture, but a polyculture, the way that prairies are, because polycultures offer benefits for one another. They are, in fact, what Otto Leopold said, biotic communities. So that, for example, one of the diseases that gets corn now is a disease that happens when raindrops bounce off the soil and hit the sort of lower levels of corn plants. That can happen when you have something flat like soil. It doesn't happen in a natural prairie because there are all kinds of other things down there to absorb the rainfall. It doesn't. You don't get that bounce. And so what they're trying to do is just to create these kinds of polycultures that would cut down on soil erosion and the kinds of problems that we face with the monocultures that we have now. In places like Iowa, it takes. I've heard the statistic that Paul Grucco has used. It takes more than a bushel of soil that's eroded to grow a bushel of corn. That's a lot. Plus, you also have the inputs of oil that go in both the form of fuel for tractors and in fertilizers and in pesticides and biocides. So you have, I mean, essentially what we have created in American agriculture is a place where we put many more calories into the food that we can possibly get out of it. Another really good example of that is a head of lettuce, which might be grown in California and then shipped to New York. Lettuce has almost no calories in it. So that as a calorie thing, it doesn't make sense to be growing lettuce like that.
This kind of touches on that. Do you have any sense as to where you see agribusiness moving? We live in Central California, 12 years, and it's huge agribusiness complexes down there where, individual farmers have now been replaced, of course, by the mega kinds of things, which are using all the modern technology can offer. Where are we headed?
Well, and they sucked out the water from the aquifers.
Right.
They're pumping up the water table in years of drought, and Central California will drop tremendously. And all kinds of repercussions.
Right. I would say in the short run, that's not going to change because you can make short-term profits at doing that. And since corporations have to balance their books in the short term, that's likely to be the way that it goes. We would need to restructure incentives to get people to think more long-term. That can be done politically, although it would be difficult since the big corporations are big players in politics. In the long run, I think we're moving towards what David Orr describes as a situation in which virtue and greed collide. This system that we're in right now is going to, as a historian, I would say that this system is going to look like an age of extravagance, and maybe an age of irrationality, this last 200 years. And it will be a very small part of the planet's history, if there is a future of history after this, because people before have lived more or less sustainable lives, although not all populations before 1700 were living sustainably, but they certainly were living more sustainably than we were. And people are going to have to live sustainably afterward. Simply, there is no other choice to that. Big agriculture will have to do that sooner or later. Agriculture has changed in many ways, even in the last 15 years. The soil erosion problem has been so bad that there is now no-till or sort of minimal-till agriculture that has, I think, 80% of farms in the United States now are doing that. That's a fairly important transformation in 20 years. It's nowhere near sustainable agriculture, but it's a move in that direction.
What percent did you say?
I think 80% of farms are doing that.
I was just thinking in terms of plowing. I grew up on a farm in northern Minnesota. We plowed, six, eight inches deep. Now, they don't do that.
Yeah.
At least that's my impression, they don't.
Right. I mean, now there's less interference, and the land grant institutions are beginning to catch on to some of this stuff. But still, in many ways, since a lot of the research that they do is done for corporations, they're still within the what I would call the mega technical system.
I was just thinking that we have some no plowing going on in the grass fields in Western Oregon now because the field burning problem is so bad, and that's good. But what's happening, they're using Roundup for weed killing and so on. So our big question is, what's happening to all the wild seed that used to come up in the crops, and that's kind of a sustainable base of diversity, which is now really being killed off because they're just using the weed killers.
Yeah, there are a few places in the country where they're collecting it. There's a place in Iowa and there's a place in Arizona which are collecting, just inventorying all the possible seeds that they can of all varieties, but all particularly of crop varieties. One of the things that's happened with crops like corn is that as they've become more and more commercially sold, the number of corn breeds has sort of really narrowed down, and at some point, if you find either an insect or a disease that really can go after that kind of corn, we're going to have an agricultural disaster of a scope that is almost unimaginable, because we don't have the varieties of corn now that we used to have. So these people who are saving seeds will be in the right place at that time, although they probably won't have enough seeds to save it.
It also seems as if we've bred a lot of flavor out of some of our fruits, like apples don't seem to taste like apples did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, yeah.
And part of it's we've gone to economies of scale, and the economies of scale have been supported by artificially cheap oil. If we paid the full price of transportation, or sort of this full cost accounting that I've been talking about, it would be cheaper to have local orchards, and apples grow in lots of different places. St. Olaf discovered, inspired by some of this stuff, St. Olaf began a project called the College and the Biosphere to try to figure out what our resource flows were and how we might adjust them. We discovered, much to our interest and dismay, that the apple juice that we were drinking came from West Germany. Because we were getting stuff from wholesalers, and they just sort of packaged together wherever they could get stuff the most cheaply at a particular time. Even though there are orchards and organic orchards in our county, that was easy enough to change. Most of the things that, in terms of food flows, we found we were not doing very well in terms of sustainable agriculture or anything like that. But they're very, very difficult to change because we have a population of 2,800 students who have to be fed every day. And if in the local market there are sort of waves in the market, if there's a wave in the local Rice County corn crop or something like that, we can't wait 2 weeks or a year to feed the students. So we do go to sort of larger wholesalers who are depending on world resources to feed our students. Although St. Olaf, as late as the 1950s, had its own farms. And we still do have farms, and we're converting the ones that we own still slowly to sustainable agriculture. But those farms are not actually used to feed the students anymore. We used to have dairy farms and all the milk at St. Olaf until the 50s came from the St. Olaf dairy farms. And there are still residents of Northfield who can remember getting ice cream at the physical plant at St. Olaf because St. Olaf made its own ice cream. These are the kinds of things that it would be good to go back to.
The State Psychiatric Hospital, where I worked up until the 50s, had a sustainable population. The patients worked on the farms and they grew their own, they made their own bread. It was just a sustainable community. And yeah, of course, somebody decided that wasn't a good thing to make the patients work. So they threw it all out the window, sold the land. Mm-hmm. Now the patients have nothing to do.
Right.
Some experts say that the world can sustain 2 to 3 billion people. We're about 6 billion now. Do you agree with that 2 to 3 billion number?
I don't know. I've seen estimates that people that I respect say that it can sustain 10 billion people.
Really?
But we're going to be there very fast. Mm-hmm. We're going to be there in about 15 years. So, because we're on a sort of population curve that just goes like that. There are increases in productivity in agriculture that are going up, but they're not going up at any rate, anywhere the rate that the population is. So we are coming for some major famines and things like that. The reason that the people that I'm reading say that we could sustain more than that is that intensive agriculture, where say people have an acre and cultivate it very carefully and pay attention to it and replenish it, actually is more productive than conventional agriculture. So there are ways in which it's possible to imagine supporting a large population. One of the things that's going to be difficult to imagine is supporting a large population like that of, say, 10 billion people, where a couple hundred million of us are living like we are right now.
Yeah.
9 billion people are going to be pretty pissed off, I think.
So we think about population control, population zero.
Well, we do need to think about population control. Usually when we think about population control, we think about population control in the third world, though, and we need to think about population impact. We also need to think about population control in a country like ours, where kids consume, an average American born now, will consume between 40 and 80 times the amount of a child in India. So, you know, I have two kids, so I have about, I have 160 times the amount of, I have the same number of kids, essentially, as somebody in India who has 160 kids. Thank God I don't have to discipline them all. I would need to be in that session over there, right? But it's true. I mean, the way that we use resources is real important. And it is real important for us to think about how to scale down, because there's no way that you're going to tell third world countries, you know, you need to limit your population and your resource use when we're using them at the rate that we are now. And one of the nice things about things like what the Todds are doing or the regenerative design book is to see that we can consume a tremendous amount less than we do and still live lives that are remarkably refreshing and fulfilling, and maybe even more fulfilling than the ones that we lead now, because we will be more interested in more things, I think. I was thinking the other day about why I like coming to Holden so much, and part of it is that my attention is on more different things here at Holden than it normally is. Usually I'm kind of focused now onto whatever it is I'm teaching tomorrow or whatever's for dinner tonight. And at Holden, they have made it possible for us to pay attention to more things, I think, than we normally do. And that's, I love that. And if I'm a normal human being, a lot of people would debate that. That would be the sort of thing that these solar sewage walls would get us interested in. We would begin to see a lot more things about our lives that are interesting, and to be a part of the solution of problems in our lives as well.
This is off the agricultural or sustainable nature track in a way, but what's being done in terms of models of urban development that get us away from sprawl and people having big yards? And
that's my topic for Saturday. But I'll give you a preview.
I won't be here.
Okay.
What time is your Saturday class?
It's at 10:30, right before they put me on the bus. There's actually some very, very interesting stuff going on, what's called in urban planning, new urban villages or neo-traditionalism, which is basically to say, when you ask Americans where they'd like to live, a lot of them say small towns. And what they have in mind when they think about small towns is that sort of front porch culture where people know each other and talk to each other a lot. And so the new urban design is to have housing that's clustered more closely than suburbs. In fact, clustered quite closely with more common areas that people can use. Some of them, like Seaside, Florida, which is a town that's actually up and built and run, it was done by a private developer, would mandate, for example, front porch sizes and the distance that a front porch can be from the front sidewalk, because they're trying to structure architecture, as architecture always does, it structures the way that we interact with one another. Here at Holden, for example, this is my favorite room to teach in, because this circle says something that no other room at Holden says. This architecture structures the interactions that go on here, I think. Essentially, the new urban planners are trying to figure that out. And so, for example, they say urban planning ought to be done by neighborhood. Neighborhoods ought to be walkable distances. There ought to be mixed uses in neighborhoods so that you don't have to drive to get a gallon of milk or something like that. That you ought to be able to go to the post office in your neighborhood. These are all things that are possible. These are all things that have actually happened. These are all things that are still happening in some places in the United States, but they require a lot of rezoning kinds of things. In this book on regenerative design, they describe in here a center for regenerative design at Cal State Pomona, where they have actually built this thing, and they wanted to have a long pedestrian pathway that led through it. Well, the fire rules in that county are that you have to be able to have something wide enough to put two fire engines side by side on. And what this does is create a big batch of concrete in there that pedestrians don't need, and they're not going to have cars on that campus. So it's a kind of useless space, plus it absorbs heat and reflects the sun, plus there's water runoff that they have to handle from it. But the zoning rules essentially say that. Or in the suburbs, most suburbs have a 35 to 44 foot width rule. Streets have to be that wide, which means that houses across the street from each other are really quite some distance from each other. And they're not close enough to provide the interactions that older block forms used to do. There's a book by Dolores Hayden called Redesigning the American Dream, where she does some playing around with just old block forms, which are kind of interesting. You know, the normal block has houses all facing the street, and then usually an alleyway in the back, which is where you go in to park your car or something like that. And she says, essentially, take all the car stuff out, put it on the streets, and make that whole area on the inside there into a commons. Put a garden out there. Put a fountain in that area. Put a little playground out there. Rezone the thing so that you could have mother-in-law apartments and things like that, so that you'd have more generations in a neighborhood than we currently do. So I think the solutions to our problems are being thought about, and they're possible.